This is disc number 4.
Oster put the check on the coffee table, as if to say the matter had been settled. Then he leaned back on the sofa and looked Quinn in the eyes. "There's a much more important question than the check," he said. "The fact that my name has been mixed up in this. I don't understand it at all." "I wonder if you've had any trouble with your phone lately. Wires sometimes get crossed. A person tries to call a number, and even though he dials correctly, he gets someone else." "Yes, that's happened to me before. But even if my phone was broken, that doesn't explain the real problem. It would tell us why the call went to you, but not why they wanted to speak to me in the first place." "Is it possible that you know the people involved?" "I've never heard of the Stillmans. Maybe someone wanted to play a practical joke on you." "I don't hang around with people like that." "You never know. But the fact is, it's not a joke. It's a real case with real people."
"Yes," said Quinn after a long silence. "I'm aware of that."
They had come to the end of what they could talk about. Beyond that point, there was nothing. The random thoughts of men who knew nothing. Quinn realized that he should be going. He had been there almost an hour, and the time was approaching for his call to Virginia Stillman. Nevertheless, he was reluctant to move. The chair was comfortable, and the beer had gone slightly to his head. This Oster was the first intelligent person he had spoken to in a long time. He had read Quinn's old work. He had admired it. He had been looking forward to more. In spite of everything, it was impossible for Quinn not to feel glad of this. They sat there for a short time without saying anything. At last, Oster gave a little shrug, which seemed to acknowledge that they had come to an impasse. He stood up and said, "I was about to make some lunch for myself. It's no trouble making it for two." Quinn hesitated. It was as though Oster had read his thoughts, divining the thing he wanted most, to eat, to have an excuse to stay a while. "I really should be going," he said. "But, yes, thank you. A little food can't do any harm." "How does a ham omelet sound?"
"Sounds good."
Oster retreated to the kitchen to prepare the food. Quinn would have liked to offer to help, but he could not budge. His body felt like a stone. For want of any other idea, he closed his eyes. In the past, it had sometimes comforted him to make the world disappear. This time, however, Quinn found nothing interesting inside his head. It seemed as though things had ground to a halt in there. Then, from the darkness, he began to hear a voice, a chanting, idiotic voice that sang the same sentence over and over again. "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs." He opened his eyes to make the words stop. There was bread and butter, more beer, knives and forks, salt and pepper, napkins and omelets, two of them, oozing on white plates. Quinn ate with crude intensity, polishing off the meal in what seemed a matter of seconds. After that, he made a great effort to be calm. Tears lurked mysteriously behind his eyes, and his voice seemed to tremble as he spoke. But somehow, he managed to hold his own. To prove that he was not a self-obsessed ingrate, he began to question Oster about his writing. Oster was somewhat reticent about it, but at last he conceded that he was working on a book of essays. The current piece was about Don Quixote. "One of my favorite books," said Quinn. "Yes, mine too. There's nothing like it." Quinn asked him about the essay. "I suppose you could call it speculative, since I'm not really out to prove anything. In fact, it's all done tongue-in-cheek. An imaginative reading, I guess you could say."
"What's the gist?"
"It mostly has to do with the authorship of the book, who wrote it, and how it was written."
"Is there any question?"
"Of course not, but I mean the book inside the book Cervantes wrote, the one he imagined he was writing."
"Ah."
"It's quite simple. Cervantes, if you remember, goes to great lengths to convince the reader that he is not the author. The book, he says, was written in Arabic by Cid Hamid Benengeli. Cervantes describes how he discovered the manuscript by chance one day in the market at Toledo. He hires someone to translate it for him into Spanish, and thereafter he presents himself as no more than the editor of the translation. In fact, he cannot even vouch for the accuracy of the translation itself. And yet he goes on to say, Quinn added, that Cid Hamid Benengeli's is the only true version of Don Quixote's story. All the other versions are frauds written by imposters. He makes a great point of insisting that everything in the book really happened in the world. Exactly, because the book, after all, is an attack on the dangers of the make-believe. He couldn't very well offer a work of the imagination to do that, could he? He had to claim that it was real. Still, I've always suspected that Cervantes devoured those old romances. You can't hate something so violently unless a part of you also loves it. In some sense, Don Quixote was just a stand-in for himself. I agree with you. What better portrait of a writer than to show a man who has been bewitched by books? Precisely. In any case, since the book is supposed to be real, it follows that the story has to be written by an eyewitness to the events that take place in it. But Cid Hamid, the acknowledged author, never makes an appearance. Not once does he claim to be present at what happens. So my question is this. Who is Cid Hamid Benengeli? Yes, I see what you're getting at. The theory I present in the essay is that he is actually a combination of four different people. Sancho Panza is, of course, the witness. There's no other candidate, since he is the only one who accompanies Don Quixote on all his adventures, but Sancho can neither read nor write. Therefore, he cannot be the author. On the other hand, we know that Sancho has a great gift for language. In spite of his inane malapropisms, he can talk circles around everyone else in the book. It seems perfectly possible to me that he dictated the story to someone else, namely to the barber and the priest, Don Quixote's good friends. They put the story into proper literary form, in Spanish, and then turned the manuscript over to Samson Carrasco, the bachelor from Salamanca, who proceeded to translate it into Arabic. Cervantes found the translation, had it rendered back into Spanish, and then published the book, The Adventures of Don Quixote. But why would Sancho and the others go to all that trouble? To cure Don Quixote of his madness. They want to save their friend. Remember, in the beginning they burn his books of chivalry, but that has no effect. The Knight of the Sad Countenance does not give up his obsession. Then, at one time or another, they all go out looking for him in various disguises, as a woman in distress, as the Knight of the Mirrors, as the Knight of the White Moon, in order to lure Don Quixote back home. In the end, they are actually successful. The book was just one of their ploys. The idea was to hold a mirror up to Don Quixote's madness, to record each of his absurd and ludicrous delusions, so that when he finally read the book himself, he would see the error of his ways. I like that. Yes, but there's one last twist. Don Quixote, in my view, was not really mad. He only pretended to be. In fact, he orchestrated the whole thing himself. Remember, throughout the book, Don Quixote is preoccupied by the question of posterity. Again and again, he wonders how accurately his chronicler will record his adventures. This implies knowledge on his part. He knows beforehand that this chronicler exists. And who else is it but Sancho Panza, the faithful squire whom Don Quixote has chosen for exactly this purpose? In the same way, he chose the three others to play the roles he destined for them. It was Don Quixote who engineered the Benengeli Quartet. And not only did he select the authors, it was probably he who translated the Arabic manuscript back into Spanish. We shouldn't put it past him. For a man so skilled in the art of disguise, darkening his skin and donning the clothes of a Moor, could not have been very difficult. I like to imagine that scene in the marketplace at Toledo, Cervantes hiring Don Quixote to decipher the story of Don Quixote himself. There's great beauty to it. But you still haven't explained why a man like Don Quixote would disrupt his tranquil life to engage in such an elaborate hoax. That's the most interesting part of all. In my opinion, Don Quixote was conducting an experiment. He wanted to test the gullibility of his fellow men. Would it be possible, he wondered, to stand up before the world and with the utmost conviction spew out lies and nonsense? To say that windmills were knights, that a barber's basin was a helmet, that puppets were real people? Would it be possible to persuade others to agree with what he said, even though they did not believe him? In other words, to what extent would people tolerate blasphemies if they gave them amusement? The answer is obvious, isn't it? To any extent, for the proof is that we still read the book. It remains highly amusing to us, and that's finally all anyone wants out of a book, to be amused. Auster leaned back on the sofa, smiled with a certain ironic pleasure, and lit a cigarette. The man was obviously enjoying himself, but the precise nature of that pleasure eluded Quinn. It seemed to be a kind of soundless laughter, a joke that stopped short of its punchline, a generalized mirth that had no object. Quinn was about to say something in response to Auster's theory, but he was not given the chance. Just as he opened his mouth to speak, he was interrupted by a clattering of keys at the front door, the sound of the door opening and then slamming shut, and a burst of voices. Auster's face perked up at the sound. He rose from his seat, excused himself to Quinn, and walked quickly towards the door. Quinn heard laughter in the hallway, first from a woman and then from a child, the high and the higher, a staccato of ringing shrapnel, and then the basso rumbling of Auster's guffaw. The child spoke, "Daddy, look what I found!" And then the woman explained that it had been lying on the street, and why not? It seemed perfectly okay. A moment later, he heard the child running towards him down the hall. The child shot into the living room, caught sight of Quinn, and stopped dead in his tracks. He was a blonde-haired boy of 5 or 6. "Good afternoon," said Quinn. The boy, rapidly withdrawing into shyness, managed no more than a faint hello. In his left hand, he held a red object that Quinn could not identify. Quinn asked the boy what it was.
"It's a yo-yo,"
he answered, opening his hand to show him.
"I found it on the street."
"Does it work?" The boy gave an exaggerated pantomime shrug.
"Dunno. Siri can't do it, and I don't know how."
Quinn asked him if he could try, and the boy walked over and put it in his hand. As he examined the yo-yo, he could hear the child breathing beside him, watching his every move. The yo-yo was plastic, similar to the ones he had played with years ago, but more elaborate somehow, an artifact of the space age. Quinn fastened the loop at the end of the string around his middle finger, stood up, and gave it a try. The yo-yo gave off a fluted, whistling sound as it descended, and sparks shot off inside it. The boy gasped. But then the yo-yo stopped, dangling at the end of its line. "A great philosopher once said," muttered Quinn, "that the way up and the way down are one and the same."
"But you didn't make it go up," said the boy. "It only went down."
"You have to keep trying." Quinn was rewinding the spool for another attempt when Auster and his wife entered the room. He looked up and saw the woman first. In that one brief moment, he knew that he was in trouble. She was a tall, thin blonde, radiantly beautiful, with an energy and happiness that seemed to make everything around her invisible. It was too much for Quinn. He felt as though Auster were taunting him with the things he had lost, and he responded with envy and rage, a lacerating self-pity. Yes. He too would have liked to have this wife and this child, to sit around all day spouting drivel about old books, to be surrounded by yo-yos and ham omelets and fountain pens. He prayed to himself for deliverance. Auster saw the yo-yo in his hand and said, "I see you've already met. Daniel, he said to the boy, this is Daniel. And then to Quinn with that same ironic smile, Daniel, this is Daniel. The boy burst out laughing and said,
everybody's Daniel.
That's right, said Quinn. I'm you and you're me.
And around it goes,
shouted the boy, suddenly spreading his arms and spinning around the room like a gyroscope. And this, said Auster, turning to the woman, is my wife, Siri. The wife smiled her smile, said she was glad to meet Quinn, as though she meant it, and then extended her hand to him. He shook it, feeling the uncanny slenderness of her bones, and asked if her name was Norwegian. Not many people know that, she said.
Do you come from Norway?
Indirectly, she said, by way of Northfield, Minnesota. And then she laughed her laugh, and Quinn felt a little more of himself collapse. I know this is sort of last minute, Auster said, but if you have some time to spare, why don't you stay and have dinner with us?
Ah, said Quinn, struggling to keep himself in check. That's very kind, but I really must be going. I'm late as it is.
He made one last effort, smiling at Auster's wife and waving goodbye to the boy. So long, Daniel, he said, walking towards the door. The boy looked at him from across the room and laughed again.
Goodbye, myself, he said.
Auster accompanied him to the door. He said, I'll call you as soon as the check clears. Are you in the book?
Yes, said Quinn. The only one.
If you need me for anything, said Auster, just call. I'll be happy to help. Auster reached out to shake hands with him, and Quinn realized that he was still holding the yo-yo. He placed it in Auster's right hand, patted him gently on the shoulder, and left.
Chapter 11. Quinn was nowhere now. He had nothing. He knew nothing. He knew that he knew nothing. Not only had he been sent back to the beginning, he was now before the beginning, and so far before the beginning that it was worse than any end he could imagine. His watch read nearly 6. Quinn walked home the way he had come, lengthening his strides with each new block. By the time he came to his street, he was running. It's June 2nd, he told himself. Try to remember that. This is New York, and tomorrow will be June 3rd. If all goes well, the following day will be the 4th. But nothing is certain. The hour had long since passed for his call to Virginia Stillman, and he debated whether to go through with it. Would it be possible to ignore her? Could he abandon everything now just like that? Yes, he said to himself. It was possible. He could forget about the case, get back to his routine, write another book. He could take a trip if he liked, even leave the country for a while. He could go to Paris, for example. Yes, that was possible. But anywhere would do, he thought, anywhere at all. He sat down in his living room and looked at the walls. They had once been white, he remembered, but now they had turned a curious shade of yellow. Perhaps one day they would drift further into dinginess, lapsing into gray or even brown, like some piece of aging fruit. A white wall becomes a yellow wall becomes a gray wall, he said to himself. The paint becomes exhausted, the city encroaches with its soot, the plaster crumbles within. Changes, then more changes still. He smoked a cigarette, and then another, and then another. He looked at his hands, saw that they were dirty, and got up to wash them. In the bathroom, with the water running in the sink, he decided to shave as well. He lathered his face, took out a clean blade, and started scraping off his beard. For some reason, he found it unpleasant to look in the mirror and kept trying to avoid himself with his eyes. You're getting old, he said to himself. You're turning into an old fart. Then he went into the kitchen, ate a bowl of cornflakes, and smoked another cigarette. It was 7 o'clock now. Once again, he debated whether to call Virginia Stillman. As he turned the question over in his mind, it occurred to him that he no longer had an opinion. He saw the argument for making the call, and at the same time he saw the argument for not making it.
In the end, it was etiquette that decided. It would not be fair to disappear without telling her first. After that, it would be perfectly acceptable. As long as you tell people what you're going to do, he reasoned, it doesn't matter. Then you are free to do what you want. The number, however, was busy. He waited 5 minutes and dialed again. Again, the number was busy. For the next hour, Quinn alternated between dialing and waiting, always with the same result. At last, he called the operator and asked whether the phone was out of order. There would be a charge of 30 cents, he was told. Then came a crackling in the wires, the sound of further dialing, more voices. Quinn tried to imagine what the operators looked like. Then the first woman spoke to him again. The number was busy. Quinn did not know what to think. There were so many possibilities, he could not even begin. Stillman? The phone off the hook? Someone else altogether? He turned on the television and watched the first two innings of the Mets game. Then he dialed once again. Same thing. In the top of the third, St. Louis scored on a walk, a stolen base, an infield out, and a sacrifice fly. The Mets matched that run in their half of the inning on a double by Wilson and a single by Youngblood. Quinn realized that he didn't care. A beer commercial came on and he turned off the sound. For the 20th time, he tried to reach Virginia Stillman, and for the 20th time, the same thing happened. In the top of the fourth, St. Louis scored 5 runs, and Quinn turned off the picture as well. He found his red notebook, sat down at his desk, and wrote steadily for the next 2 hours. He did not bother to read over what he had written. Then he called Virginia Stillman and got another busy signal. He slammed the receiver down so hard that the plastic cracked. When he tried to call again, he could no longer get a dial tone. He stood up, went into the kitchen, and made another bowl of cornflakes. Then he went to bed. In his dream, which he later forgot, he found himself walking down Broadway, holding Oster's son by the hand. Quinn spent the following day on his feet. He started early, just after 8 o'clock, and did not stop to consider where he was going. As it happened, he saw many things that day he had never noticed before. Every 20 minutes, he would go into a phone booth and call Virginia Stillman. As it had been the night before, so it was today. By now, Quinn expected the number to be busy. It no longer even bothered him. The busy signal had become a counterpoint to his steps, a metronome beating steadily inside the random noises of the city. There was comfort in the thought that whenever he dialed the number, the sound would be there for him, never swerving in its denial, negating speech and the possibility of speech, as insistent as the beating of a heart. Virginia and Peter Stillman were shut off from him now. But he could soothe his conscience with the thought that he was still trying. Whatever darkness they were leading him into, he had not abandoned them yet. He walked down Broadway to 72nd Street, turned east to Central Park West, and followed it to 59th Street and the Statue of Columbus. Then he turned east once again, moving along Central Park South and Madison Avenue, and then cut right, walking downtown to Grand Central Station. After circling haphazardly for a few blocks, he continued south for a while, came to the juncture of Broadway and Fifth Avenue at 23rd Street, paused to look at the Flatiron Building, and then shifted course, taking a westward turn until he reached 7th Avenue, at which point he veered left and progressed further downtown. At Sheridan Square, he turned east again, ambling down Waverly Place, crossing 6th Avenue and continuing on to Washington Square. He walked through the arch and made his way south among the crowds, stopping momentarily to watch a juggler perform on a slack rope stretched between a light pole and a tree trunk. Then he left the little park at its downtown east corner, went through the university housing project with its patches of green grass, and turned right at Houston Street. At West Broadway, he turned again, this time to the left, and proceeded onward to Canal. Angling slightly to his right, he passed through a vest pocket park and swung around to Varick Street, walked by number 6, where he had once lived, and then regained his southern course, picking up West Broadway again where it merged with Varick. West Broadway took him to the base of the World Trade Center and on into the lobby of one of the towers, where he made his 13th call of the day to Virginia Stillman. Quinn decided to eat something, entered one of the fast food places on the ground floor, and leisurely consumed a sandwich as he did some work in the red notebook. Afterwards, he walked east again, wandering through the narrow streets of the financial district, and then headed further south towards Bowling Green, where he saw the water and the seagulls above it, careening in the midday light. For a moment, he considered taking a ride on the Staten Island ferry, but then thought better of it and began tracking his way to the north. At Fulton Street, he slid to his right and followed the northeastward path of East Broadway, which led through the miasma of the Lower East Side and then up into Chinatown. From there, he found the Bowery, which carried him along to 14th Street. He then hooked left, cut through Union Square, and continued uptown along Park Avenue South. At 23rd Street, he jockeyed north. A few blocks later, he jutted right again, went one block to the east, and then walked up 3rd Avenue for a while. At 32nd Street, he turned right, came upon 2nd Avenue, turned left, moved uptown another three blocks, and then turned right one last time, whereupon he met up with 1st Avenue. He then walked the remaining seven blocks to the United Nations and decided to take a short rest. He sat down on a stone bench in the plaza and breathed deeply, idling in the air and the light with closed eyes. Then he opened the red notebook, took the deaf-mute's pen from his pocket, and began a new page. For the first time since he had bought the red notebook, what he wrote that day had nothing to do with the Stillman case. Rather, he concentrated on the things he had seen while walking. He did not stop to think about what he was doing, nor did he analyze the possible implications of this uncustomary act. He felt an urge to record certain facts, and he wanted to put them down on paper before he forgot them. Today, as never before, the tramps, the down-and-outs, the shopping bag ladies, the drifters and drunks, they range from the merely destitute to the wretchedly broken. Wherever you turn, they are there, in good neighborhoods and bad. Some beg with a semblance of pride. "Give me this money," they seem to say, "and soon I will be back there with the rest of you, rushing back and forth on my daily rounds." Others have given up hope of ever leaving their tramphood. They lie there, sprawled out on the sidewalk with their hat or cup or box, not even bothering to look up at the passerby, too defeated even to thank the ones who drop a coin beside them. Still others try to work for the money they are given. The blind pencil sellers, the winos who wash the windshield of your car. Some tell stories, usually tragic accounts of their own lives, as if to give their benefactors something for their kindness, even if only words. Others have real talents. The old black man today, for example, who tap-danced while juggling cigarettes, still dignified, clearly once a vaudevillian, dressed in a purple suit with a green shirt and a yellow tie, his mouth fixed in a half-remembered stage smile. There was also the pavement chalk artists and musicians, saxophonists, electric guitarists, fiddlers. Occasionally, you will even come across a genius, as I did today. A clarinetist of no particular age, wearing a hat that obscured his face, and sitting cross-legged on the sidewalk in the manner of a snake charmer. Directly in front of him were two wind-up monkeys, one with a tambourine and the other with a drum, with the one shaking and the other banging, beating out a weird and precise syncopation. The man would improvise endless tiny variations on his instrument, his body swaying stiffly back and forth, energetically miming the monkey's rhythm. He played jauntily and with flair, crisp and looping figures in the minor mode, as if glad to be there with his mechanical friends and closed in the universe he had created, never once looking up. It went on and on, always finally the same. And yet the longer I listened, the harder I found it to leave. To be inside that music, to be drawn into the circle of its repetitions. Perhaps that is a place where one could finally disappear. But beggars and performers make up only a small part of the vagabond population. They are the aristocracy, the elite of the fallen. Far more numerous are those with nothing to do, with nowhere to go. Many are drunks, but that term does not do justice to the devastation they embody. Hulks of despair, clothed in rags, their faces bruised and bleeding, they shuffle through the streets as though in chains. Asleep in doorways, staggering insanely through traffic, collapsing on sidewalks, they seem to be everywhere the moment you look for them. Some will starve to death. Others will die of exposure. Still others will be beaten or burned or tortured. For every soul lost in this particular hell, there are several others locked inside madness, unable to exit to the world that stands at the threshold of their bodies. Even though they seem to be there, they cannot be counted as present. The man, for example, who goes everywhere with a set of drumsticks, pounding the pavement with them in a reckless, nonsensical rhythm, stooped over awkwardly as he advances along the street, beating and beating away at the cement. Perhaps he thinks he is doing important work. Perhaps if he did not do what he did, the city would fall apart. Perhaps the moon would spin out of its orbit and come crashing into the earth. There are the ones who talk to themselves, who mutter, who scream, who curse, who groan, who tell themselves stories as if to someone else. The man I saw today, sitting like a heap of garbage in front of Grand Central Station, the crowds rushing past him, saying in a loud, panic-stricken voice, "Third Marines! Eating bees! The bees crawling out of my mouth!" Or the woman shouting at an invisible companion, "And what if I don't want to? What if I just fucking don't want to?" There are the women with their shopping bags and the men with their cardboard boxes, hauling their possessions from one place to the next, forever on the move, as if it mattered where they were. There is the man wrapped in the American flag. There is the woman with a Halloween mask on her face. There is the man in a ravaged overcoat, his shoes wrapped in rags, carrying a perfectly pressed white shirt on a hanger, still sheathed in the dry cleaner's plastic. There is the man in a business suit with bare feet and a football helmet on his head. There is the woman whose clothes are covered from head to toe with presidential campaign buttons. There is the man who walks with his face in his hands, weeping hysterically and saying over and over again, "No, no, no. He's dead. He's not dead. No, no, no. He's dead. He's not dead." Baudelaire. "Il me semble que je serai toujours bien là où je ne suis pas." In other words, it seems to me that I will always be happy in the place where I am not. Or more bluntly, wherever I am not is the place where I am myself. Or else, taking the bull by the horns, anywhere out of the world. It was almost evening. Quinn closed the red notebook and put the pen in his pocket. He wanted to think a little more about what he had written, but found he could not. The air around him was soft, almost sweet, as though it no longer belonged to the city. He stood up from the bench, stretched his arms and legs, and walked to a phone booth, where he called Virginia Stillman again. Then he went to dinner. In the restaurant, he realized that he had come to a decision about things. Without his even knowing it, the answer was already there for him, sitting fully formed in his head. The busy signal, he saw now, had not been arbitrary. It had been a sign, and it was telling him that he could not yet break his connection with the case, even if he wanted to. He had tried to contact Virginia Stillman in order to tell her that he was through, but the fates had not allowed it. Quinn paused to consider this. Was fate really the word he wanted to use? It seemed like such a ponderous and old-fashioned choice. and yet as he probed more deeply into it, he discovered that was precisely what he meant to say. Or, if not precisely, it came closer than any other term he could think of. Fate in the sense of what was, of what happened to be. It was something like the word it in the phrase, it is raining, or it is night. What that it referred to, Quinn had never known. A generalized condition of things as they were, perhaps. The state of isness that was the ground on which the happenings of the world took place. He could not be any more definite than that. But perhaps he was not really searching for anything definite. It was fate, then. Whatever he thought of it, however much he might want it to be different, there was nothing he could do about it. He had said yes to a proposition, and now he was powerless to undo that yes. That meant only one thing. He had to go through with it. There could not be two answers. It was either this or that. And so it was, whether he liked it or not. The business about Auster was clearly a mistake. Perhaps there had once been a private detective in New York with that name. The husband of Peter's nurse was a retired policeman, therefore not a young man. In his day, there had no doubt been an Auster with a good reputation, and he had naturally thought of him when called upon to provide a detective. He had looked in the telephone book, had found only one person with that name, and assumed he had the right man. Then he gave the number to the Stillmans. At that point, the second mistake had occurred. There had been a foul-up in the lines, and somehow his number had got crossed with Auster's. That kind of thing happened every day, and so he had received the call, which, anyway, had been destined for the wrong man. It all made perfect sense. One problem still remained. If he was unable to contact Virginia Stillman, if, as he believed, he was meant not to contact her, how exactly was he to proceed? His job was to protect Peter, to make sure that no harm came to him. Did it matter what Virginia Stillman thought he was doing as long as he did what he was supposed to do? Ideally, an operative should maintain close contact with his client. That had always been one of Max Work's principles. But was it really necessary? As long as Quinn did his job, how could it matter? If there were any misunderstandings, surely they could be cleared up once the case was settled. He could proceed then as he wished. He would no longer have to telephone Virginia Stillman. He could abandon the oracular busy signal once and for all. From now on, there would be no stopping him. It would be impossible for Stillman to come near Peter without Quinn knowing about it. Quinn paid up his check, put a mentholated toothpick in his mouth, and began walking again. He did not have far to go. Along the way, he stopped at a 24-hour Citibank and checked his balance with the automatic teller. There were $349 in his account. He withdrew $300, put the cash in his pocket, and continued uptown. At 57th Street, he turned left and walked to Park Avenue. There he turned right and went on walking north until 69th Street, at which point he turned onto the Stillman's block. The building looked the same as it had on the first day. He glanced up to see if there were any lights on in the apartment, but he could not remember which windows were theirs. The street was utterly quiet. No cars drove down it, no people passed. Quinn stepped across to the other side, found a spot for himself in a narrow alleyway, and settled in for the night. Chapter 12. A long time passed. Exactly how long, it is impossible to say. Weeks, certainly, but perhaps even months. The account of this period is less full than the author would have liked, but information is scarce, and he has preferred to pass over in silence what could not be definitely confirmed. Since this story is based entirely on facts, the author feels it his duty not to overstep the bounds of the verifiable, to resist at all costs the perils of invention. Even the Red Notebook, which until now has provided a detailed account of Quinn's experiences, is suspect. We cannot say for certain what happened to Quinn during this period, for it is at this point in the story that he began to lose his grip. He remained for the most part in the alley. It was not uncomfortable once he got used to it, and it had the advantage of being well hidden from view. From there, he could observe all the comings and goings at the Stillman's building. No one left and no one entered without his seeing who it was. In the beginning, it surprised him that he saw neither Virginia nor Peter. But there were many delivery men constantly coming and going, and eventually he realized that it was not necessary for them to leave the building. Everything could be brought to them. It was then that Quinn understood that they, too, were holing up, waiting inside their apartment for the case to end. Little by little, Quinn adapted to his new life. There were a number of problems to be faced, but one by one he managed to solve them. First of all, there was the question of food. Because utmost vigilance was required of him, he was reluctant to leave his post for any length of time. It tormented him to think that something might happen in his absence, and he made every effort to minimize the risks. He had read somewhere that between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m., there were more people asleep in their beds than at any other time. Statistically speaking, the chances were best that nothing would happen during that hour, and therefore Quinn chose it as the time to do his shopping. On Lexington Avenue, not far north, there was an all-night grocery, and at 3:30 every morning, Quinn would walk there at a brisk pace, for the exercise and also to save time, and buy whatever he needed for the next 24 hours. It turned out not to be much, and as it happened, less and less as time went on. For Quinn learned that eating did not necessarily solve the problem of food. A meal was no more than a fragile defense against the inevitability of the next meal. Food itself could never answer the question of food. It only delayed the moment when the question would have to be asked in earnest. The greatest danger, therefore, was in eating too much. If he took in more than he should, his appetite for the next meal increased, and thus more food was needed to satisfy him. By keeping a close and constant watch on himself, Quinn was gradually able to reverse the process. His ambition was to eat as little as possible, and in this way to stave off his hunger. In the best of all worlds, he might have been able to approach absolute zero, but he did not want to be overly ambitious in his present circumstances. Rather, he kept the total fast in his mind as an ideal, a state of perfection he could aspire to but never achieve. He did not want to starve himself to death, and he reminded himself of this every day. He simply wanted to leave himself free to think of the things that truly concerned him. For now, that meant keeping the case uppermost in his thoughts. Fortunately, this coincided with his other major ambition— to make the $300 last as long as he could. It goes without saying that Quinn lost a good deal of weight during this period. His second problem was sleep. He could not stay awake all the time, and yet that was really what the situation required. Here, too, he was forced to make certain concessions. As with eating, Quinn felt that he could make do with less than he was accustomed to. Instead of the 6 to 8 hours of sleep he was used to getting, he decided to limit himself to 3 or 4. Adjusting to this was difficult, but far more difficult was the problem of how to distribute these hours so as to maintain maximum vigilance. Clearly, he could not sleep for 3 or 4 hours in a row. The risks were simply too great. Theoretically, the most efficient use of the time would be to sleep for 30 seconds every 5 or 6 minutes. That would reduce his chances of missing something almost to nil. But he realized that this was physically impossible. On the other hand, using this impossibility as a kind of model, he tried to train himself into taking a series of short naps, alternating between sleeping and waking as often as he could. It was a long struggle, demanding discipline and concentration, for the longer the experiment went on, the more exhausted he became. In the beginning, he tried for sequences of 45 minutes each, then gradually reduced them to 30 minutes. Towards the end, he had begun to manage the 15-minute nap with a fair amount of success. He was helped in his efforts by a nearby church, whose bells rang every 15 minutes, one stroke on the quarter hour, two strokes on the half hour, three strokes on the three-quarter hour, and four strokes on the hour, followed by the appropriate number of strokes for the hour itself. Quinn lived by the rhythm of that clock, and eventually he had trouble distinguishing it from his own pulse. Starting at midnight, he would begin his routine, closing his eyes and falling asleep before the clock had struck 12. 15 minutes later, he would wake. At the half-hour, double stroke, fall asleep, and at the three-quarter-hour, triple stroke, wake once more. At 3:30, he would go off for his food, return by 4 o'clock, and then go to sleep again. His dreams during this period were few. When they did occur, they were strange, brief visions of the immediate, his hands, his shoes, the brick wall beside him. Nor was there ever a moment when he was not dead tired. His third problem was shelter, but this was more easily solved than the other two. Fortunately, the weather remained warm, and as late spring moved into summer, there was little rain. Every now and then there was a shower and once or twice a downpour, with thunder and lightning, but all in all it was not bad, and Quinn never stopped giving thanks for his luck. At the back of the alley, there was a large metal bin for garbage, and whenever it rained at night, Quinn would climb into it for protection. Inside, the smell was overpowering, and it would permeate his clothes for days on end, but Quinn preferred it to getting wet, for he did not want to run the risk of catching cold or falling ill. Happily, the lid had been bent out of shape and did not fit tightly over the bin. In one corner there was a gap of 6 or 8 inches that formed a kind of air hole for Quinn to breathe through, sticking his nose out into the night. By standing on his knees on top of the garbage and leaning his body against one wall of the bin, he found that he was not altogether uncomfortable. On clear nights, he would sleep under the bin, positioning his head in such a way that the moment he opened his eyes, he could see the front door of the Stillman's building. As for emptying his bladder, he usually did this in the far corner of the alley, behind the bin, and with his back to the street. His bowels were another matter, and for this he would climb into the bin to ensure privacy. There were also a number of plastic garbage cans beside the bin, and from one of these Quinn was usually able to find a sufficiently clean newspaper to wipe himself. Although once, in an emergency, he was forced to use a page from the red notebook. As for washing and shaving, these were two of the things that Quinn learned to live without. How he managed to keep himself hidden during this period is a mystery, but it seems that no one discovered him or called his presence to the attention of the authorities. No doubt he learned early on the schedule of the garbage collectors and made sure to be out of the alley when they came. Likewise, the building superintendent, who deposited the trash each evening in the bin and the cans. Remarkable as it seems, no one ever noticed Quinn. It was as though he had melted into the walls of the city. The problems of housekeeping and material life occupied a certain portion of each day. For the most part, however, Quinn had time on his hands. Because he did not want anyone to see him, he had to avoid other people as systematically as he could. He could not look at them, he could not talk to them, he could not think about them. Quinn had always thought of himself as a man who liked to be alone. For the past 5 years, in fact, he had actively sought it. But it was only now, as his life continued in the alley, that he began to understand the true nature of solitude. He had nothing to fall back on anymore but himself. And of all the things he discovered during the days he was there, this was the one he did not doubt, that he was falling. What he did not understand, however, was this. In that he was falling, how could he be expected to catch himself as well? Was it possible to be at the top and the bottom at the same time? It did not seem to make sense. He spent many hours looking up at the sky. From his position at the back of the alley, wedged in between the bin and the wall, there were few other things to see, and as the days passed, he began to take pleasure in the world overhead. He saw that, above all, the sky was never still. Even on cloudless days, when the blue seemed to be everywhere, there were constant little shifts, gradual disturbances as the sky thinned out and grew thick, the sudden whitenesses of planes, birds, and flying papers. Clouds complicated the picture, and Quinn spent many afternoons studying them, trying to learn their ways, seeing if he could not predict what would happen to them. He became familiar with the cirrus, the cumulus, the stratus, the nimbus, and all their various combinations, watching for each one in its turn, and seeing how the sky would change under its influence. Clouds, too, introduced the matter of color, and there was a wide range to contend with, spanning from black to white, with an infinity of grays between. These all had to be investigated, measured, and deciphered. On top of this, there were the pastels that formed whenever the sun and the clouds interacted at certain times of day. The spectrum of variables was immense, the result depending on the temperatures of the different atmosphere levels, the types of clouds present in the sky, and where the sun happened to be at that particular moment. From all this came the reds and pinks that Quinn liked so much, the purples and vermilions, the oranges and lavenders, the golds and feathery persimmons. Nothing lasted for long. The colors would soon disperse, merging with others and moving on or fading as the night appeared. Almost always, there was a wind to hasten these events. From where he sat in the alley, Quinn could rarely feel it, but by watching its effect on the clouds, he could gauge its intensity and the nature of the air it carried. One by one, all weathers passed over his head, from sunshine to storms, from gloom to radiance. There were the dawns and dusks to observe, the midday transformations, the early evenings, the nights. Even in its blackness, the sky did not rest. Clouds drifted through the dark. The moon was forever in a different form. The wind continued to blow. Sometimes a star even settled into Quinn's patch of sky, and as he looked up, he would wonder if it was still there or if it had not burned out long ago. The days, therefore, came and went. Stillman did not appear. Quinn's money ran out at last. For some time he had been stealing himself for this moment, and towards the end he hoarded his funds with maniacal precision. No penny was spent without first judging the necessity of what he thought he needed, without first weighing all the consequences, pro and con. But not even the most stringent economies could halt the march of the inevitable. It was sometime in mid-August when Quinn discovered that he no longer could hold out. The author has confirmed this date through diligent research. It is possible, however, that this moment occurred as early as late July, or as late as early September, since all investigations of this sort must make allowances for a certain margin of error. But to the best of his knowledge, having considered the evidence carefully and sifted through all apparent contradictions, the author places the following events in August, somewhere between the 12th and 25th of the month. Quinn had almost nothing now, a few coins that amounted to less than a dollar. He was certain that money had arrived for him during his absence. It was simply a matter of retrieving the checks from his mailbox at the post office, taking them to the bank, and cashing them. If all went well, he could be back to East 69th Street within a few hours. We will never know the agonies he suffered at having to leave his spot. He did not have enough money to take the bus. For the first time in many weeks, then, he began to walk. It was odd to be on his feet again, moving steadily from one place to the next, swinging his arms back and forth, feeling the pavement under the soles of his shoes. And yet there he was, walking west on 69th Street, turning right on Madison Avenue and beginning to make his way north. His legs were weak, and he felt as though his head were made of air. He had to stop every now and then to catch his breath, and once, on the brink of falling, he had to grab hold of a lamppost. He found that things went better if he lifted his feet as little as possible, shuffling forward with slow, sliding steps. In this way, he could conserve his strength for the corners, where he had to balance himself carefully before and after each step up and down from the curb. At 84th Street, he paused momentarily in front of a shop. There was a mirror on the facade, and for the first time since he had begun his vigil, Quinn saw himself. It was not that he had been afraid to confront his own image. Quite simply, it had not occurred to him. He had been too busy with his job to think about himself, and it was as though the question of his appearance had ceased to exist. Now, as he looked at himself in the shop mirror, he was neither shocked nor disappointed. He had no feeling about it at all, for the fact was that he did not recognize the person he saw there as himself. He thought that he had spotted a stranger in the mirror, and in that first moment he turned around sharply to see who it was. But there was no one near him. Then he turned back to examine the mirror more carefully. Feature by feature, he studied the face in front of him and slowly began to notice that this person bore a certain resemblance to the man he had always thought of as himself. Yes, it seemed more than likely that this was Quinn. Even now, however, he was not upset. The transformation in his appearance had been so drastic that he could not help but be fascinated by it. He had turned into a bum. His clothes were discolored, disheveled, debauched by filth. His face was covered by a thick black beard with tiny flecks of gray in it. His hair was long and tangled, matted into tufts behind his ears and crawling down in curls almost to his shoulders. More than anything else, he reminded himself of Robinson Crusoe, and he marveled at how quickly these changes had taken place in him. It had been no more than a matter of months, and in that time, he had become someone else. He tried to remember himself as he had been before, but he found it difficult. He looked at this new Quinn and shrugged. It did not really matter. He had been one thing before, and now he was another. It was neither better nor worse. It was different, and that was all. He continued uptown for several more blocks, then turned left, crossed Fifth Avenue, and walked along the wall of Central Park. At 96th Street, he entered the park and found himself glad to be among the grass and trees. Late summer had exhausted much of the greenness, and here and there the ground showed through in brown, dusty patches. But the trees overhead were still filled with leaves, and everywhere there was a sparkling of light and shade that struck Quinn as miraculous and beautiful. It was late morning, and the heavy heat of the afternoon lay several hours off. Halfway through the park, Quinn was overtaken by an urge to rest. There were no streets here, no city blocks to mark the stages of his progress, and it seemed to him suddenly that he had been walking for hours. Making it to the other side of the park felt as though it would take another day or two of dogged hiking. He went on for a few more minutes, but at last his legs gave out. There was an oak tree not far from where he stood, and Quinn went for it now, staggering in the way a drunk gropes for his bed after an all-night binge. Using the red notebook as a pillow, he lay down on a grassy mound just north of the tree and fell asleep. It was the first unbroken sleep he had had in months, and he did not wake until it was morning again. His watch said that it was 9:30, and he cringed to think of the time he had lost. Quinn stood up and began loping towards the west, amazed that his strength was back, but cursing himself for the hours he had wasted in getting it. He was beyond consolation. No matter what he did now, he felt that he would always be too late. He could run for 100 years, and still he would arrive just as the doors were closing. He emerged from the park at 96th Street and continued west. At the corner of Columbus Avenue, he saw a telephone booth, which suddenly reminded him of Oster and the $500 check. Perhaps he could save time by collecting the money now. He could go directly to Oster, put the cash in his pocket, and avoid the trip to the post office and the bank. But would Oster have the cash on hand? If not, perhaps they could arrange to meet at Oster's bank. Quinn entered the booth, dug into his pocket, and removed what money was left, 2 dimes, a quarter, and 8 pennies. He dialed information for the number, got his dime back in the coin return box, deposited the dime again, and dialed. Oster picked up on the 3rd ring.
"Quinn here," said Quinn.
He heard a groan on the other end.
"Where the hell have you been hiding?"
There was irritation in Oster's voice.
"I've called you 1,000 times.
"I've been busy, working on the case."
"The case?"
"The case. The Stillman case. Remember?"
"Of course I remember."
"That's why I'm calling. I want to come for the money now, the $500.
"What money?"
"The check, remember? The check I gave you. The one made out to Paul Oster?"
"Of course I remember, but there is no money. That's why I've been trying to call you."
"You had no right to spend it," Quinn shouted, suddenly beside himself. "That money belonged to me."
"I didn't spend it. The check bounced."
"I don't believe you.
You can come here and see the letter from the bank if you want. It's sitting here on my desk. The check was no good."
"That's absurd."
"Yes, it is. But it hardly matters now, does it?"
"Of course it matters. I need the money to go on with the case."
"But there is no case. It's all over."
"What are you talking about?"
"The same thing you are, the Stillman case."
"But what do you mean it's over? I'm still working on it."
"I can't believe it."
"Stop being so goddamn mysterious. I don't have the slightest idea what you're talking about."
"I don't believe you don't know. Where the hell have you been? Don't you read the newspapers?"
"Newspapers? God damn it, say what you mean. I don't have time to read newspapers."
There was a silence on the other end, and for a moment Quinn felt that the conversation was over, that he had somehow fallen asleep and had just now woken up to find the telephone in his hand.
"Stillman jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge," Oster said. "He committed suicide 2.5 months ago."
"You're lying."
"It was all over the papers. You can check for yourself."
Quinn said nothing.
"It was your Stillman," Oster went on. "The one who used to be a professor at Columbia? They say he died in midair, before he even hit the water."
"And Peter? What about Peter?"
"I have no idea."
"Does anybody know?"
"Impossible to say. You'd have to find that out for yourself."
"Yes, I suppose so," said Quinn.
Then, without saying goodbye to Oster, he hung up. He took the other dime and used it to call Virginia Stillman. He still knew the number by heart. A mechanical voice spoke the number back to him and announced that it had been disconnected. The voice then repeated the message, and afterwards the line went dead. Quinn could not be sure what he felt. In those first moments, it was as though he felt nothing, as though the whole thing added up to nothing at all. He decided to postpone thinking about it. There would be time for that later, he thought. For now, the only thing that seemed to matter was going home. He would return to his apartment, take off his clothes, and sit in a hot bath. Then he would look through the new magazines, play a few records, do a little house cleaning. Then, perhaps, he would begin to think about it. He walked back to 107th Street. The keys to his house were still in his pocket, and as he unlocked his front door and walked up the 3 flights to his apartment, he felt almost happy. But then he stepped into the apartment, and that was the end of that. Everything had changed. It seemed like another place altogether, and Quinn thought he must have entered the wrong apartment by mistake. He backed into the hall and checked the number on the door. No, he had not been wrong. It was his apartment. It was his key that had opened the door.
He walked back inside and took stock of the situation. The furniture had been rearranged. Where there had once been a table, there was now a chair. Where there had once been a sofa, there was now a table. There were new pictures on the walls. A new rug was on the floor. And his desk? He looked for it, but could not find it. He studied the furniture more carefully and saw that it was not his. What had been there the last time he was in the apartment had been removed. His desk was gone. His books were gone. The child drawings of his dead son were gone. He went from the living room to the bedroom. His bed was gone. His bureau was gone. He opened the top drawer of the bureau that was there. Women's underthings lay tangled in random clumps, panties, bras, slips. The next drawer held women's sweaters. Quinn went no further than that. On a table near the bed, there was a framed photograph of a blonde, beefy-faced young man. Another photograph showed the same young man smiling, standing in the snow with his arm around an insipid-looking girl. She, too, was smiling. Behind them, there was a ski slope, a man with two skis on his shoulder and the blue winter sky. Quinn went back to the living room and sat down in a chair. He saw a half-smoked cigarette with lipstick on it in an ashtray. He lit it up and smoked it. Then he went into the kitchen, opened the refrigerator, and found some orange juice and a loaf of bread. He drank the juice, ate three slices of bread, and then returned to the living room, where he sat down in the chair again. 15 minutes later, he heard footsteps coming up the stairs, a jangling of keys outside the door, and then the girl from the photograph entered the apartment. She was wearing a white nurse's uniform and held a brown grocery bag in her arms. When she saw Quinn, she dropped the bag and screamed. Or else she screamed first and then dropped the bag. Quinn could never be sure which. The bag ripped open when it hit the floor, and milk gurgled in a white path toward the edge of the rug. Quinn stood up, raised his hand in a gesture of peace, and told her not to worry. He wasn't going to hurt her. The only thing he wanted to know was why she was living in his apartment. He took the key from his pocket and held it up in the air as if to prove his good intentions. It took him a while to convince her, but at last her panic subsided. That did not mean she'd begun to trust him, or that she was any less afraid. She hung by the open door, ready to make a dash for it at the first sign of trouble. Quinn held his distance, not wanting to make things worse. His mouth kept talking, explaining again and again that she was living in his house. She clearly did not believe one word of it, but she listened in order to humor him, no doubt hoping that he would talk himself out and finally leave.
"I've been living here for a month," she said. "It's my apartment. I signed a year's lease."
"But why do I have the key?" Quinn asked for the 7th or 8th time. "Doesn't that convince you?"
"There are hundreds of ways you could have got that key."
"Didn't they tell you there was someone living here when you rented the place?"
"They said it was a writer, but he disappeared, hadn't paid his rent in months."
"That's me," shouted Quinn. "I'm the writer."
The girl looked him over coldly and laughed.
"A writer? That's the funniest thing I ever heard. Just look at you. I've never seen a bigger mess in all my life."
"I've had some difficulties lately," muttered Quinn by way of explanation, "but it's only temporary."
"The landlord told me he was glad to get rid of you anyway. He doesn't like tenants who don't have jobs. They use too much heat and run down the fixtures."
"Do you know what happened to my things?"
"What things?"
"My books, my furniture, my papers."
"I have no idea. They probably sold what they could and threw the rest away. Everything was cleared out before I moved in."
Quinn let out a deep sigh. He had come to the end of himself. He could feel it now, as though a great truth had finally dawned in him. There was nothing left.
"Do you realize what this means?" he asked.
"Frankly, I don't care," the girl said. "It's your problem, not mine. I just want you to get out of here right now. This is my place, and I want you out. If you don't leave, I'm going to call the police and have you arrested."
It didn't matter anymore. He could stand there arguing with the girl for the rest of the day and still he wouldn't get his apartment back. It was gone. He was gone. everything was gone. He stammered something inaudible, excused himself for taking up her time, and walked past her out the door. Chapter 13. Because it no longer mattered to him what happened, Quinn was not surprised that the front door at 69th Street opened without a key. Nor was he surprised when he reached the ninth floor and walked down the corridor to the Stillman's apartment that that door should be open as well. Least of all did it surprise him to find the apartment empty. The place had been stripped bare, and the rooms now held nothing. Each one was identical to every other, a wooden floor and four white walls. This made no particular impression on Quinn. He was exhausted, and the only thing he could think of was closing his eyes. He went to one of the rooms at the back of the apartment, a small space that measured no more than 10 feet by 6 feet. It had one wire mesh window that gave onto a view of the air shaft, and of all the rooms, it seemed to be the darkest. Within this room, there was a second door, which led to a windowless cubicle that contained a toilet and a sink. Quinn put the red notebook on the floor, removed the deaf-mute's pen from his pocket, and tossed it onto the red notebook. Then he took off his watch and put it in his pocket. After that, he took off all his clothes, opened the window, and one by one dropped each thing down the air shaft. First his right shoe, then his left shoe. One sock, then the other sock. His shirt, his jacket, his underpants, his pants. He did not look out to watch them fall, nor did he check to see where they landed. Then he closed the window, lay down in the center of the floor, and went to sleep. It was dark in the room when he woke up. Quinn could not be sure how much time had passed, whether it was the night of that day or the night of the next. It was even possible, he thought, that it was not night at all. Perhaps it was merely dark inside the room, and outside, beyond the window, the sun was shining. For several moments, he considered getting up and going to the window to see, but then he decided it did not matter. If it was not night now, he thought, then night would come later. That was certain, and whether he looked out the window or not, the answer would be the same. On the other hand, if it was in fact night here in New York, then surely the sun was shining somewhere else. In China, for example, it was no doubt mid-afternoon, and the rice farmers were mopping sweat from their brows. Night and day were no more than relative terms. They did not refer to an absolute condition. At any given moment, it was always both. The only reason we did not know it was because we could not be in two places at the same time. Quinn also considered getting up and going to another room, but then he realized that he was quite happy where he was. It was comfortable here in the spot he had chosen, and he found that he enjoyed lying on his back with his eyes open, looking up at the ceiling, or what would have been the ceiling had he been able to see it. Only one thing was lacking for him, and that was the sky. He realized that he missed having it overhead after so many days and nights spent in the open. But he was inside now, and no matter what room he chose to camp in, the sky would remain hidden, inaccessible even at the farthest limit of sight.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please insert disc number 5.